This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. Nobody wants to see the corner. When middle-class Americans of any race drive by a corner full of crack and heroin addicts, there's a symphony of automatic locks snapping shut on car doors and tires squealing with acceleration to get the hell out of there. If anyone is caught at a stoplight and sees the folks who hang out on the corner, it's easy to dismiss them as lowlifes, a collection of small-time thieves, whores who are working for the next packet of crack, and sad-eyed, brain-dead teenagers, drug runners with guns. That's why it's so amazing that for the last 5 weeks, HBO has been running a Sunday night miniseries called The Corner. The show is about the real people behind the crackheads and heroin addicts. It's about the humanity of the people caught up in a subculture where drugs are all that matters. Families are shattered, careers are lost, and children are exposed to the most awful side of life. Who could have predicted that this series would win the highest possible ratings, 4 stars, from USA Today? The Wall Street Journal said despite the graphic depictions of junkie life, the show is enormously seductive and absorbing. The LA Times said the series is one of the smartest, most powerful dramas ever seen on TV. And it's worth noting that TV this good cannot be seen on the big networks. The TV critics said that advertisers would be too uptight about the political backlash from negative depictions of black people. And the ugliness of people using needles to shoot up drugs in their necks, toes, and anywhere else, well, that would be too rough for the networks. But what stands out in this series is not the drug use, and it's not the race of the characters. It is the humanity of the characters. The series is based on a nonfiction book titled The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood by David Simon and Edward Burns. And the TV series, directed by Charles Dutton, stays true to the real characters that are portrayed in the book. Each episode of The Corner begins and ends with documentary-type interviews with the people who spend their time on the corner. Here's a clip from the end of one episode.
Oh, Kurt, you've been out here on Monroe and Fed a long time.
Who you telling? I've been on this corner since that lamppost over there was a goddamn twig. I'm a soldier. Yeah.
So I guess you've seen the younger ones coming up, seen a lot of people come on the corner for the first time. Do you know Gary McCullough?
Oh, yeah. Gary. Gary had it going on. Money, cars, houses. You split that stock market. Guy's making crazy money before he stumbled. Gave a lot of it away, too.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. To who?
People around the way. Anyone who needed it, really. Gary was always soft. Good-hearted.
Let me ask you something. Why did he fall?
Started fooling around with that pipe.
Gary McCullough started out on crack?
That Ready Rock changed the whole game around. Used to be different. Used to be rules of this shit. But with that rock, you saw people becoming drug addicts. Made heroin look like it wasn't shit. Wasn't menfolk either. You had women on the pipe, children too. And that's when it really started getting bad.
Yeah, but in Gary's case, I mean, what led him to the corner at all, do you think?
Well, I look at it like he got hurt. He gave so much away and so little came back, you know. You know how it is, you know. But the world could be that way.
So he's hiding the hurt in the drugs.
Man, he's just like everybody else, looking for a little love. Everybody gotta have some love.
That was a clip from the HBO miniseries, The Corner. Joining me this hour is David Simon, executive producer of the HBO series. He's also author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood, and Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets. Also with me is one of the real people profiled by Simon in his book, Fran Boyd. She is now an outreach coordinator for the New Hope Treatment Center in Baltimore. They both join me from the studios of member station WJHU in Baltimore. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
If you want to join the conversation, our number here is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-8255. Talk. Let me start with you, David Simon, and ask, what's been the reaction to this series? What are you hearing?
For the most part, overwhelmingly good. We had, and I think HBO had, a certain amount of trepidation going in because of the subject matter. And the feeling was, if we can do this the right way, it'll obviate a lot of the sort of political considerations that usually keep stuff like this off of the air. But that was a testy thing, and there was, I think everybody held their breath before it, before the reaction started coming from the critics and also from viewers.
And largely the fear was what? That people would say this was a horrible depiction of black life, or this is sort of a tawdry look at any sort of, you know, of drug use, or what was the, what was,
yeah,
the fear?
I think the fear was, it was the same as when the book itself came out, and you had a book just on a raw political level by two white journalists about a predominantly black neighborhood in which there was a great deal of drug use. And there was that sort of palpable moment when it could go one way or the other. And fortunately, I think when the book came out, a great deal of the black leadership in Baltimore got behind it and sort of understood the intent immediately and saw the humanity of the characters that we were portraying and saw the intent of the book. And I think the same thing happened with HBO. I mean, you're coming off a time where network television has done a very poor job of presenting the totality of the African-American experience. So here comes this miniseries in six parts that is not emphasizing middle class or working class ethic, but that of the drug culture, the urban drug culture. And, you know, the timing couldn't have been worse, but I think the material speaks for itself.
Fran Boyd, you are played as a lead character in the miniseries, but you're a real person.
Yes, I am.
And one of the things that strikes me about the show is the humanity of the characters that you see behind the horrors of the kind of life that's being led, that these are real people. In the case of the family that's at the center of the show, these are people who were struggling and making it into the middle class, but then because of drugs, stumbled, as it was said in the little clip we heard, and fall back into living on the corner in horrible conditions. When you look at the series, do you see your life, or do you think it's overly dramatic?
No, I see my life exactly the way that it used to be. I see. Well, what I'm really most proud of is that the way that Candy portrayed my part. Every day I would go on the set and watch the things that she did, just so I would see that she was doing everything that really happened. And so far, I haven't seen anything that's not true.
Well, I got to tell you, the part is played by Candy Alexander, and I did not like your character. I thought, no, man, that is a self-serving woman. And you got to tell the listeners here who may not have seen the HBO series that, in fact, Fran, it looked to me like you had pulled Gary down, that Gary was the one who was struggling to make it, and that your character was a real party girl and got involved with cocaine. And the family then starts to slide backwards as you make money, financial demands on Gary.
Okay, but what people have to understand is that when Gary and I was together, Gary didn't use drugs. Gary didn't stop using until him and I separated, which was about 3 years later that I found out he was using drugs. So I wasn't the reason why Gary started using.
When you are looking at the character in the miniseries, there are also children involved. One is Andre, who is a 16-year-old drug dealer, your son. And the other is a little boy, I guess around 3 or 4 years old. Are those real characters?
My youngest son, D-Rod, he was about
eight
at the time. Yes, they are real characters.
And I thought, my gosh, look at what happens to the children. Look at the things that they see. Tell me about the reality of that. Did they, in fact, see all those horrible things going on?
Yes, they did. Well, one thing about going through addiction, you know, people have to understand that it doesn't just affect you. It affects everybody around you, even the children. But what I tried to do, even when I was using, I tried to still be that mother that I was supposed to be. I still tried to take care of my children. I kept a roof over their head and tried to try to supply them with all their needs. You know, I just did the best that I could at that time.
And that actually was sort of a viable difference, strange as it may sound, between Fran and a lot of the situations we were encountering on Fayette Street. In the wake of that cocaine epidemic of the late 80s and early 90s in Baltimore, a lot of the strength of that neighborhood, which were the single mothers, really crumbled. And there were children that were effectively raising themselves in the street that we were encountering daily. And I think in Fran's instance, she was trying to have a foot in both worlds. And it actually had an effect because Fran's been clean now, coming up on 5 years in August. And Darod has been raised in the county for sort of the critical period of early adolescence. And it's turned out quite differently for him than for Andre. Mm-hmm.
You know what struck me, as I said, the humanity of the characters, that these are real people with real hearts and real stories behind the drug use. But at the same time, it also struck me that, in a sense, we were seeing generations repeat, because you'd see the Andre go out there, he's selling drugs, he's not going to school, and you would see so many of his friends, they're running around with guns, they're shooting at each other, they're threatening each other, they're threatening other people. At one point, Andre ends up in jail. It just seemed as if it was, you know, fate that this was going to repeat generation after generation. Has that been the true case, Fran? Is that repeated now in the next generation?
Well, I don't really think so. I think that a lot of times when it is repeated, it's up to the person. I've seen families that come off of Fair Street where everybody is not out there. For the most part, children that grow up around it, most of them do fall into it, but you do have some that do make it out. So I don't think that it has to repeat generation after generation.
Well, what happened to Andre? He was depicted in the show as a budding drug dealer. I haven't seen the final episode, but
I think
what happened.
Maybe we shouldn't ruin the ruin the ending for anybody. You know, Andre is one case, and Darod's another, and
my niece.
Yeah, I mean there are some people who, you know, there were families that wouldn't let their kids off the stoop, and who kept a really tight rein on the kids, and they were not caught in that corner culture, but it was very hard, and there was an awful lot of temptation out there. One of the things I think the series, I mean, one of the things that I'm really loath to do is put sort of names and labels on, you know, I mean, DeAndre is in fact dealing drugs, but the label drug dealer has a sort of an overwhelming connotation in our society, and in a place like West Baltimore where for a lot of 15-year-olds, slinging drugs for a little while is almost a rite of passage. It's less an occupation or a vocation than it is sort of a fundamental backdrop to growing up. You know, anybody can slip in and out of a label as an act of personal will, and that's sort of one of the lessons of the corner, is that in the beginning, you're right, Juan. I mean, in the beginning, Fran's character begins as being fascinating but not necessarily likable, and then once she starts making that journey, the labels no longer apply.
My guests are David Simon, who's the author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood. He's also the executive producer and writer of the HBO miniseries. Also with me, Fran Boyd, who's the outreach coordinator for the New Hope Treatment Center in Baltimore. Fran is a former addict, and her life story is one of those that's being dramatized in the HBO series. We start this segment of the show with a clip from The Corner, in which Fran is played by the actress Candy Alexander.
I first started messing with heroin when my sister Darlene died. She got burnt up in a fire.
I didn't know about your sister. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. I couldn't hardly deal with it, you know? Then this family friend, he come around after the funeral. He said, do a line of this to make you feel better. He laid it out. I sniffed it up. Day after that, he come around again. He laid out some more. Day after that, he didn't come. So then it was me out looking for him. So you know how that went.
Yeah.
But that wasn't no thing, because like I said, I've been getting high since middle school.
What about your mother and father?
I don't want to talk about them. Ask me something else. Annie, you got a cigarette, girl? Well, I knew you was holding some. Thank you, babe.
Can I ask about DeAndre?
What you want to know?
Well, he's must be tough raising him, you know? He's been in a little trouble.
Look, DeAndre, no, I don't want him getting caught up in this mess. I threw him out the house when I found out he was selling drugs.
Oh, come on, Fran. Don't you think you're sending him mixed messages? Basically, I mean, you know, you're living in a shooting gallery.
Yeah. Well, the right motherfucking message must have gotten through, because he ain't out here trying to sling no more coke. Let me tell you something else. My sons ain't never been without a place to lay their heads, and they ain't never gone hungry neither. Not like a lot of these little kids you see out here just running totally wild.
Well, I'm not saying you're...
I have been there for DeAndre, okay? At every school meeting and every juvenile hearing downtown, I've been there. And yeah, I likes to get high, okay? But I have been a mother to that boy and to Derod. So why don't you move the fuck up off my stoop? Huh?
Fran, did that really happen? Did it happen that way?
Yes, it did.
That was, I gotta say, when I first met Fran, it was relatively easy to get to know Gary, and it was somewhat easy to get to know Andre. But Fran didn't want any part of me or the book when we first met, and, you know, a few of the wrong questions asked, and it was never, I think, that impolitic, but there was an icy chill. Fran had a game face that just terrified me.
Let's go to Carolyn in Charleston, South Carolina. Carolyn, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I guess I'm just going to say what you guys were saying, what the response you didn't want, in that I think this is another stereotypical depiction of black life. You could just as easily make the case that and depict the middle class black life. While I appreciate what everybody's going through there, I just think it's a negative portrayal, and I think there needs to be a wider view of what black life is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that that's probably true for the networks as a whole. I would agree with you. However, I'd say you're kind of hard-pressed to make the case about HBO requiring that. This is the network that brought Laurel Avenue, which was, in fact, a depiction of black middle-class and working-class ethics, as well as the Tuskegee Airmen and
television.
Hang on a second, David. Let Carolyn speak. What did you? I didn't get what you said, Carolyn.
I think that there's a certain type of depiction of black life that does get put on television for whatever reason. Maybe that's not your fault. Maybe that's the network executive's fault. But for me, I think this is 2000. We need to see the broad variety of what black life is. One, you did a show yesterday on stereotypes,
right?
And I think that this helps. Again, reinforce those negative stereotypes.
All right. Thanks for your call, Carol. David, you were saying that you disagree.
I just couldn't disagree more. First of all, HBO is not only the network of The Corner, it's also the network of Laurel Avenue and Tuskegee Airmen and A Lesson Before Dying. It has presented the gamut of black life, I think, better than any other television network out there. Second of all, I think the real victory of The Corner is that it confounds stereotypes. You're going right to the place where all the stereotypes are manufactured. I mean, I wrote for Homicide on NBC for you know, a very well-written show, and it had a lot of strong black leads.
Based on the book that you wrote.
Right. And, you know, but I have to say, every time we got around to writing somebody who was caught up in one of those cases, you know, from a black neighborhood, if they were a witness or a user or a suspect, those were the stereotypes. You know, I think that the real victory of The Corner, and unless you watch it, and I'd be hard pressed to wonder whether the lady we were speaking to had watched it, is that you go there, you are expecting to know these people based on what the media culture has given us of places like Fayette Street, and all of a sudden, boom. You know, you meet Fran and Gary and DeAndre and Fat Kurt and everybody else, and they are startlingly human. And that is a subversive victory. So, I mean, I've been in television now for 5 years. That is a subversive victory, because the bottom line is that when you fight a war, and we have fought the drug war for 30 years, the first thing you do is you demonize the enemy. That's the first job of propaganda. You make the enemy a little less human, and then you're able to do things like racial profiling and elimination of parole and mandatory sentences.
But David, here you hear from a caller who says she feels, in fact, you're damaging the image of black Americans.
And I couldn't agree more, and I would like to know...
Disagree, you mean, I think.
I'm sorry, I couldn't disagree more. I'd like to know at what point, in what scene did that? I mean, what scene did these people lapse into stereotype? Did these characters suddenly become something, you know... Can a white racist watch The Corner and find reasons to remain a racist? I'm sure he can, or I'm sure she can. I don't have an interest in writing for those people. I went to Fayette Street in 93, and I met... Fran and Gary DeAndre, and their stories were among the most compelling I ever encountered as a reporter.
All right.
Nothing's going to get in the way of me telling those stories.
Let's go to Caroline in Cleveland, Ohio. Caroline, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, hi. Gosh, you know, when I saw The Corner, I was blown away by how realistic it was. But more importantly, I thought, wow, they're bringing out a humanity in these characters who've been devastated by drug abuse. I've worked for a needle exchange in Cleveland, and I've worked with these people, and it was kind of a relief to see them portrayed on a television series. I did not think it was stereotyping them. As a matter of fact, I thought, my God, they're actually talking about people's lives that go mostly ignored. So my compliments to the TV show and to the writer.
All right. Thanks for your call, Carolyn. Let's go now to Yvette in Binghamton, New York. Yvette, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi, Yvette.
Hi. Hello, everyone. I just wanted to say I agree with the caller that just called. I've been watching the series from day one, and I just find it absolutely compelling. I couldn't stop watching it after the first time. And I have to say hats off to you, Fran. I really respect, you know, the decision you made in turning your life around. I'm originally from New York City, and... there was a corner in, you know, just about every section of Manhattan where I grew up. And I knew some of the people, you know, I knew some of the lives that were portrayed in this series. I knew people that actually lived that way. And my brother, who was older than me and has now passed away, was a heroin addict. And my family was a hardworking family, and they saw to it that I didn't, you know, get caught up into that life. But I guess we couldn't really understand why he did. And it was one thing that one of the addicts said in the program that just really stuck with me. And it's the guy who's got the really swollen hands. He really looks like a drug addict, a heroin addict.
Fat
he
Kurt.
Said the first time that he took that, you know, that heroin, he had such a high that he was compelled to keep going back so he could experience that first time. And it just helped me understand how a person could get caught up in that. And not be free. I say hats off to HBO and to the writer and for this series. It should be on network television so that people can really see the humanity of people that get caught up in this. It's also in the white neighborhoods. This is a reality that everybody has to face. This is not a black situation. This is not just about African-American people. This is about America, period. Mm-hmm. People don't want to look at the truth.
All right, Yvette, thanks for your call. I want to now go to Andre Ampre, the president of the Baltimore Substance Abuse System, Inc. Andrea, thanks for joining Talk of the Nation.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Andrea, what's been your experience in dealing with people on the corner? Is it like what we've been seeing on this HBO series?
Absolutely. I think it's certainly a very realistic portrayal of what those of us in the field of substance abuse treatment see every day.
How high is the drug abuse rate in Baltimore City?
We use a state estimate, and right now we're looking at about 60,000 addicts and alcoholics in Baltimore City, which is a city of about 650,000 people.
So about one out of every 10?
Yes.
And we're talking about what kind of addicts? Heroin? Coke? Crack? What are we talking about?
Primary drug of choice in Baltimore is heroin. Followed by crack cocaine and third alcohol.
What kind of alcohol?
No, third choice.
Oh, third choice.
Yes.
So why is Baltimore's drug addiction rate so high, especially if you compare it to other cities of the same size? That's way off the charts.
We've traditionally been a heroin city. If you go back to the days of Billie Holiday, who also died from a drug overdose, I think a lot has to do with location in terms of being, you know, halfway between New York, between Miami. You can reach us by land, air, And the poverty rate is extremely high, which makes it very susceptible, and particularly at a time when crack cocaine hit, and which actually created a job market for young folks. And then after we saw that happen, we saw an increase in the purity of heroin and a decrease in that cost. So heroin use shot up again.
You know, Ms. Amprey, one of the realities of Baltimore is that the former mayor, Kurt Schmoke, has suggested at some point that we think about not only needle exchanges to try to keep down disease, but maybe even, to some extent, some legalization. How do you deal with that?
Actually, he was talking about medicalization of the issue. Mm-hmm. And for the last 3 years here in Baltimore, we've had something called the Mayor's Initiative, which was implemented under our former mayor, Kurt L. Schmoke. And that was to expand treatment services with the goal of one day being able to offer treatment services on request, so that everyone who wants and needs services would be able to access services.
In fact, for Fran, one of our guests today, it was a big moment in the show when she finally got into rehab.
Mm-hmm.
If someone in Baltimore wants rehabilitation, wants to get off the drugs, is there treatment available immediately?
It depends on the day. For the most part, no. We are far short of treatment on request. But we do have some special funding in particular areas, such as for persons who are HIV positive, out of money for homeless persons. A lot depends on where our funding source is coming from and whether or not we happen to have slots available on a given day.
One of the themes of the show, and let me remind everyone that I'm Juan Williams and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. One of the themes of the show, Ms. Amprey, is that, in fact, the war on drugs has been a failure. And mm-hmm. I remember Charles Dutton doing one of those documentary-style discussions with a policeman. And the policeman basically says, this was a good neighborhood at one time before the drugs hit. And, you know, there's no point to us chasing, putting the same people in jail. They come out of jail. It's still like a revolving door.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you come out on that? Is the war on drugs a failure, or should we, in fact, send more reinforcements to the corner?
Well, I think what we need to do is for those persons who are already addicted, certainly to once again to be able to offer treatment on request. For those who are coming out of the criminal justice system who are in need of treatment, we ought to be able to treat those as well as voluntary clients. When you look at the whole drug strategy for the country, when you look at the amount of money that's actually going into treatment, is certainly small in comparison to your interdiction effort. And the reality is if we don't begin to treat the population that's out there, if we don't begin to offer good prevention programs, then the cycle will not only continue, but will worsen.
One last question, Ms. Amprey.
Sure.
We see young people today in the HBO miniseries, they are drug dealers, not so much the users. Are we going to see another wave of, you know, the way we saw the crack come on the scene and devastate areas? Is anything like that in the forecast?
Well, we already see it here. We see young dealers who don't see any hope in terms of getting professional jobs or the job market really being available to them, who've basically bought the American dream in terms of what they see on TV. They want the cars, the jewelry, the nice clothes. They want to be able to provide for their families. So they're going in that direction. And unless we begin to turn that around in terms of being able to offer them legitimate jobs, that will also continue to get worse.
And the rate of addiction, you suspect, will remain just as high?
Yes.
Andrea Amprey, president of the Baltimore Substance Abuse System, Inc., thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. Fran Boyd, you too would agree that things look like they could get back to that kind of epidemic stage again?
Yes, I do. I feel as though as long as the people in Baltimore that are addicted don't get the proper help that they need, then it's going to get even worse. By me being an outreach worker, I go out on corners every day, and I could see the population of the people getting younger and younger. And I think the real problem is they're not offered anything to do. Like Ms. Andrea said, there are no jobs for them. There's no treatment. And these are the things that the people in Baltimore need in order for it to get better.
David Simon, you know, we talk so often these days about how good the economy is. The good of the American economy doesn't reach down to the corner?
No, this is the naturalized unemployment rate. This is the part that's not counted. And in fact, you know, that is the real profound thing, and it reaches beyond policy and the drug war, is that the drug culture provides meaning to people that have been absolutely denied it. We didn't meet a lot of fools on Fayette Street. We met a lot of people who may have been undereducated at points, but they were as sharp as we were.
All right, David, I'm going to have to stop you right there. We're going to have to take a short break right now. Today we're talking about the corner of Fayette and Monroe, just one corner among 100 open-air drug markets in Baltimore. It's the subject of the book and the HBO miniseries, The Corner. My guests are David Simon. He's the executive producer and author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood. Also with me this hour is Fran Boyd, who's the outreach coordinator for the New Hope Treatment Center in Baltimore. Fran's story is one of those portrayed in The Corner. David, I sort of interrupted you there. I wanted you to finish your thought.
I was going to suggest that until we, you know, we've been saying just say no to drugs for the last 30 years, we have no clue what it is that the people at Monroe and Fayette are supposed to say yes to. And until we figure that out and actually abide by whatever it is we come up with and ascribe real meaning to their lives, the drugs are going to be a powerful draw.
But David, what I imagine people out there are saying to themselves, well, what do the rest of us say yes to? We say yes to getting an education, to going out there and working real hard and making the best of your life possible.
Well, you know, that can work if you're in a place where the schools have textbooks and if you're not growing up in a shooting gallery and if there's not every evidence that everybody who graduates with a Baltimore City High School degree is standing out there hanging out just the same as you are on the corner, and that the only people that are finding any viable meaning are the ones who, I mean, DeAndre felt as if he was raised for the corner, and I'm not sure he was wrong at that particular moment. There's a dramatic difference between Fran's first child, DeAndre, who struggled with the corner culture in which he was raised, and Darod. Once she moved out to Parkville, Darod latched on to a county school system that was viable, and he's doing great. I mean, you know, environment, we want to believe it's about us. We want to believe that it's about our capabilities, and if we were on Fayette Street, you know, our parents would still be our parents, our broker would still be our broker. And the truth is that the environment has meaning. It actually has an effect.
Fran, what would you say to people who would argue that what David has just put forward is a rationalization for people who have just allowed themselves to become drug addicts rather than busting their cans and getting out there and getting a job and supporting and providing for their families?
Well, I believe that what David is saying is true, because I've watched people around Fair Street just about all my life, and a lot of times it is very hard for people to get away from there. I've seen how the environment has tore down a lot of families in that area. Some people are just actually stuck around the area because they can't afford to get out. I was just fortunate enough after I got clean to move Darod away from there, and I honestly feel that had I stayed there, Darod would be on the corner himself.
All right, let's go to John in Charlotte, North Carolina. John, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yes, hi. I want to compliment your guests. I think the show is fantastic, and I look forward to it every week. I have a specific question about Gary's character. Just like one of your previous callers, I grew up in New York, and I've seen my fair share of, you know, junkies trying to score drugs. And I think it's very accurate, Gary's walk, that fast-paced walk when he's walking the street looking for drugs. And I was wondering if that was something the producers came up with, or the director, or maybe the actor.
I got to credit TK.
Extremely accurate.
Yeah, I got to credit TK Carter with coming up with that walk. That was that was something. Gary was a remarkable man, a very good-hearted man caught in a very bad situation. He's the person I miss the most from that year, you know, a real unique person. And the thing about Gary is that I think in some ways he's the soul of the piece. You know, I think if you watch the 6 hours, he is the conscience of the piece, really.
John, thanks for your call. But let me ask you, is it the case, David, that you never met a bad person, like, you know, like a low-life bad dude out there? That's the way it sounds.
Oh, yeah, no, that's, I'm not going there. I would say, and I think therein is the great lie of the drug war. I mean, I think on that corner, maybe 5% of the people we met were sociopaths, would hurt you. But 95% of them were trying to get by and were as connected to the tragedy they were undergoing as any of us would be. And I wasn't meaning to suggest before that there's an absence of personal will to getting up and getting out and getting off drugs. I mean, the story of the corner, particularly Fran's story, is an epic journey. And I am the better for having watched what she went through to get clean. I mean, she pursued, Candy said that Fran pursued sobriety with the same vengeance that she pursued getting high. And so I don't mean to suggest that, that the environment is all. But if everybody out there was as evil as the propaganda of the drug war makes it out to be, Ed and I would not be here today, because we went out to that corner every day for a year and then actually for a couple years after it. Mm-hmm. And most of the people we met, once they understood the project, were as palpably human as you or me.
Let's go to Val in Phoenix, Arizona. Val, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say kudos to your writer there. I don't get cable, so I don't actually, I haven't seen the show. But I am a recovering addict, and I think it's really important to bring to the surface that addiction is everyone's disease. It doesn't differentiate between class or color or anything. And, you know, I think it's really important that we bring this to the fore. And I also wanted to ask Fran how much clean time she had.
I have 5 years in September.
You go, girl.
You go, too.
Just past my first.
Val, how long have you been clean?
I'm just past my first year, about 4 days shy of 400 days.
How did you become an addict, Val?
I actually encountered crystal methamphetamine at work, and it's a real epidemic out west. And I just started doing it every day, a little bump to keep me awake. And before I knew it, I was in it for 3 years.
Hmm. Fran, I heard you start to ask a question.
Yeah, I was just going to let Val know that she can get all the years that she wants.
All right. Thanks for your call, Val.
Thank you.
Let's go to Mike in St. Louis.
Hi, Juan. Great show.
Thanks, Mike.
I've always believed that it's the environment, but it's in the environment that we created, and it's, I'm sitting here at a phone booth in an inner-city neighborhood, and that's where the effect is really put upon this war on drugs, which really is perverse in my mind. You know, the neighborhoods, the kids who live here have a choice of working for a low-paying job and learning how to work, or get taken the easy way out. And we sell glamour through Miami Vice and over the years all these incredible cop shows about a perverse situation where we've criminalized something that people will do anyway, and the opportunistic, the most criminal and the most violent are the ones that benefit from it. And the rest of us, especially in the inner city, are put upon by this imbalance of economics where drugs are so high value that it's, again, it's like Fran suggested, it's almost impossible to get away from this environment. And I wanted to ask her and your other guest if they thought decriminalization, while it's not a good answer, would be better than the situation now where we spend all this money basically criminalizing the rest of the world, like Colombia. The poor people of that country, are, I believe, really put upon by our thought that we can somehow solve this problem through somebody else essentially doing the decision work, the government telling us we can't take drugs.
Mike, thanks for your call. David, what do you think?
I want to raise the proposition, suggest that actually drugs are legal in Baltimore. When you have 50,000, 60,000 people going out of those corners every day, and if the police were able to lock up 60 of them on any given day and do that for a year, they would have a record number of drug arrests in Baltimore City. That's effectively legal. That's legal in the same way it's legal to drive 70 miles an hour on I-95 if everybody's doing it. And effectively, the drug war is over, except for the shouting and the random arrest. The question is, if you're in one of these places like West Baltimore or North Philly or South Chicago, what do you do with the existing framework? And I think ultimately what you have to do is admit that what began as a legitimate war against illegal drugs has now become a war on our underclass, and that until we start embracing the idea that the Gary McCulloughs and the Fran Boyds and the DeAndre McCulloughs of the world have a shared future with us, and that we start rearranging the country to allow for that, this underground economy will not be stopped by the power of arrest. It's over.
Fran, do you think, in fact, if the police had been more aggressive and had limited your ability to get the drugs, they would have helped you and helped to keep your family together?
No. If they were more aggressive as far as...
arresting people, stopping the influx of drugs into Baltimore?
Let me ask it this way, Fran. Hey. Did you ever know anybody who stopped taking drugs because it was illegal or because the police were chasing them?
No.
Why do people stop taking drugs?
Because they want to. And as far as the police is concerned, I know as far as around Fair Street is concerned, a lot of the police would sit on one corner and activity is going on another corner and they don't even move. So as far as you getting drugs, I mean, it was there. Huh. You know, so the police never even really tried. And even when they did try, a lot of times it was over by the time they got to the destination where people were serving drugs. So.
But you're not advocating that they should be more efficient and more aggressive in their war on drugs?
No, I don't.
All right. I'm Juan Williams, let me remind you, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Stephen in Forest Hill, California. Stephen, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yes. Hi, Juan.
Hi.
I'm an educator. I grew up in Southern California in what was known there as the Vadio, and divorced parents barely escaped, as the term goes. Fran, my congratulations and prayers to you.
Thank you.
I've spent years trying to decipher this issue, and Carl Jung said many years ago that we have, in the modern world, we have begun to rob people of the ability to dream. We've dehumanized them. That becomes the basis of what makes us human, the ability to dream. And as we've stolen their dreams from them and stolen their humanity from them, they turn to other sources. Some will turn to brutality and become the brutalizers, the police, the military. Some will turn to drugs and become those who can't dream any other way because it's the drug that brings them a dream. And some, by luck, by prayer, by hope, will become those who can dream once again. And it's those who will bring life back into the world, like the Frans who found a dream again, a hope, and stepped outside of that world. But, you know, this issue is so big, I could talk forever on it. But the basic point is until we can find a way to rehumanize our societies, we will never stop. Law enforcement, all these things are not the answer. They can't stop that. You can't force someone to not try to search for that dream that's been stolen from them. The Native American saw it many years ago, the hope he had a dream about it, that this was coming.
All right, Stephen. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, David, is there going to be one of our callers, I can't get to everybody today, but one of the callers asked, will The Corner become a real show? Are there going to be follow-ups to this six-part series?
No, I think we've, once we made the decision to use the real names of real people that we met on Fayette Street in the show, we're only using the material in the book. If we were going to construct, I don't think there's any great hue and cry for us to construct a show that goes on beyond the six. But if we were going to do that, the characters would by necessity need to be fictionalized because, I don't want to be caught making up stuff for 22 episodes about real people. That's why Detective Harry Edgerton of the Baltimore Police Department actually became Frank Pembleton on Homicide, because they wanted the show to go more than 9 episodes.
You know, Fran, one of the troubling things to me as a viewer of the show was to see that DeAndre's girlfriend get pregnant. I think she was like 14 or something. I suppose that really happened. It just seems so tragic in the sense that the children didn't have a chance in that community.
Yeah, well, as far as Rico getting pregnant even at 14, the same with her. You know, when you lack parents and you're just out there and nobody's there to tell you right from wrong or to teach you, the facts of life.
Right.
But the good part about it is that Rika is a remarkable today.
All right.
Fran,
that's all the time we have for today, but I'm glad to hear that good news. I'd like to thank all of you who called this hour, but especially my guest, David Simon, executive producer, writer, and the author of The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood, and Fran Boyd, Outreach Coordinator for the New Hope Treatment Center. They joined us from member station WJHU in Baltimore, Maryland. Earlier, we spoke with Andrea Amprey, President of Baltimore Substance Abuse System, Inc., from her office. In Washington, I'm Juan Williams, NPR News.